Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am excited today to have Jeff, pronounce your name, I'm going to say it wrong.
Sure, Korzenek.
Korzenek. I had it right, and then as soon as I said it, okay, Jeff Korzenek. You're going to find out that Jeff's got a fascinating resume, a fascinating passion that lines up with work. So he is the chief investment strategist, I guess, for Fifth Third Bank, where you manage the nationwide strategy of the investment management group. So I'm assuming there you guys set the allocation.
Right. I lead the team that sets the allocation for, I used to say $45 billion, but the markets have not been kind lately. So let's call it $40
billion. Wonderful. But you and I met through a guy by the name of Pete Leonard. He runs I Have a Bean, and I actually just interviewed him a week ago. So we look forward to hearing your insights as it ties into work, but then also in this broader context of just the talent pool and then specifically those that are affected by the criminal justice system. So Jeff, welcome.
Thank you so much. And I should say that a lot of my work, particularly as it relates to my being an author and public speaker on criminal justice topics, is wholly separate from my day job as a banker. And so I have a, as you and some of your listeners will be familiar with, an outside business agreement and formal regulatory issue. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention there's a little separation of church and state here.
Understand. Totally makes sense. But before we get going here, because I don't want to forget it, can you just briefly share, you wrote a book. What's the name of it? Where can they find it? And a brief synopsis of it.
Sure. The book is called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. And it was published by HarperCollins, HarperCollins Leadership Imprint last April. And it is the business case. It shares the business case and critically the best practices of hiring people with criminal records. And I would add, as I started to write this, if you're going to write to business decision makers as your audience or primary audience, though it has since expanded as by way of audience, but if you're going to write to that group, I realized you had to provide a lot of context. So I start getting into how do we get to this over-incarceration mess we're in? What are cultural implications that could change this? And what are policies that take into account the employer's perspective, which is something that's largely been missing from the policy debate?
So I'm hopeful that when we get into these questions, that one of the things that we'll get from you is why this is something of specific interest to you or passion. So if that doesn't come through, let's make sure we get that out here. So why don't you just start off and give us a little background of yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, a little bit about your career.
Sure. I was raised in Hartford, Connecticut, which you may know is a very poor city. I was raised within the city limits, but a nice street in a tough city. Went originally to Hartford Public Schools, went to a private high school, went to Princeton University, where I graduated with a degree in economics and a couple of minors. They don't call them minors, but effectively minors. But I always wanted to get on Wall Street. It took me some time. I did a detour working in London for a small British company and then landed my first Wall Street job with E.F. Hutton and Company. Which,
it's a
legendary firm that's no longer around and got taken over numerous times. And I went with the takeovers and all that and spent about 15 years doing that. Got interested in bank-based wealth management, ran a bank investment program, became then a chief investment officer of a startup RIA owned by a regional accounting firm, and then came back in 2009. I came back to bank-based wealth management and joined Fifth Third, and after a short couple of years, became their chief investment strategist, a role I've held ever since.
Maybe you can start off by explaining, as we were just briefly talking, it sounds like you've been talking about the shortage in hiring a talent a while back, and then now it's coupled with what's happening, I'm assuming a lot of facets, but part of it's the criminal justice system. How did you get to this point?
And so I was taught very early on that you have to pay attention to demographics if you're going to analyze the economy and if you're going to analyze markets. It used to be said that you'd follow the baby boomers. So when they were kids, you wanted to buy toy companies, then you wanted to buy automakers, then you wanted to invest in real estate and then asset managers as they prep save for retirement. Yep. And there's actually a lot of truth hidden in that somewhat glib statement. And as someone who's always kept an eye on demographics, it became obvious to me that we were going to have a growth problem in the US economy when the baby boomers started to retire. because we just didn't have enough births 20, 30 years ago. We got a reprieve in this country that other countries did not enjoy in the millennial generation, but they're all in. So back in 2017, 2018, I'd always include something in my presentations about the looming labor shortage. In fact, in my book, I submitted the manuscript in June of 2020 when the unemployment rate was 11%. And I basically said, we're going to come out of this with a labor shortage. And the reason for that was just simple demographics. But the pandemic, as it did with so many other areas of our economy, accelerated everything. And it accelerated the labor shortage because this, what people are calling the Great Resignation, kind of misses the point. It's really the Great Retirement. And just one data point, the St. Louis Fed issued a study in October of last year that estimated that by then 2.4 million Americans had retired early. You just can't make up for a loss like that. Yeah, we have the game of musical chairs as people move around to different positions, but fundamentally, you can't make up for the loss of 2.4 million workers in a short period of time. And even in a long period of time, we're going to struggle. You know, where we are right now, look at the JOLTS report, the Job Opening Labor Turnover Survey. We have something like 11.5 million job openings in the United States and only 6 odd million job seekers. That's a big mismatch. We've never seen anything like this.
All right. So I don't know this next question. I don't know how you're going to answer it. If you want to answer from you decide from which side you want to answer this, but how would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
You know, I'm not as close to retirement as I might like to be. On the other hand, I've always believed that and was taught as a kid, you know, you leave a room better than you found it. Okay. I'm actually a very patriotic person. You know, this country has been very good to me and my family. My mom's a German war refugee, effectively. Mm. My dad's parents were immigrants, impoverished immigrants, and we've had great opportunities. So I want that for everyone in our country. And I stumbled into these issues of second chance, fair chance hiring, giving people who've been in cycles of deep poverty and justice involvement, giving them a chance to be good citizens, contributing lives of contribution and meaning. And I decided that this, among some other projects, is a way that I can leave the room better than I found it.
And are you finding that from either your presentations or chatting around that movement is happening positive in this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I never know exactly whether my work is contributing to that, but I get things that suggest to me that it is. People who ask me to be a speaker, who ask me to come back, occasional business owner who will write me and say, hey, as a result of your work, I just made my first hire, or I'm offering a training program for incarcerated people.
Right.
The labor shortage is forcing businesses to rethink their talent strategies. And many of them are learning that the biggest pool of overlooked talent is the pool of people with criminal records.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is that many of them have tried it before and didn't know how to do it the right way. There's a right way and a wrong, lots of wrong ways to do this. And there are benefits to approaching this pool. It's not a pool of last resort. It's actually finding people who have different life experience who are very eager to prove that they are worth more than their worst mistake. That has the potential to generate a terrific worker, but you have to know who's ready. And then you need some accommodations that are specific to this labor pool, either because they have the problems of deep intergenerational poverty, you know, never seen work in their lives, no family of history of work and mentorship and those sort of things, or they have issues very specific to criminal justice involvement. Mm-hmm. You know, they might have to meet a parole officer on a regular basis during work hours. They might have conditions of parole that prevent them from going to certain job sites. So those are the issues that employers have to know about. But if they do it right, there's a very, very good track record of companies have found this is a pathway, not just to another worker, certainly not to a worker of last resort, but actually some of their most engaged and loyal employees.
So it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who happened to meet in a prison a number of years ago, and they were applying for a new job, and all indications were that he was going to get this offer. Well, turns out that, in fact, they weren't calling him back because I think that this is my read. Is that they didn't really know how to handle the situation because he admitted that he had been incarcerated. And so they were afraid that if it came back on his record, that one of the founders would want nothing to do with it. Well, turns out that actually, if you run it, he doesn't have that on his record anymore because of certain time periods and whatnot. So there's just a lot of uncertainties that I'm not so sure this person's a bad person at all, but they just didn't even know how to navigate it.
No, and it's a minefield. You know, and some of the things that I tackle in the book are best practices. Don't force people to self-disclose because they may legitimately not know what shows up on their record.
Yeah.
You know, I've had friends who had records that were expunged show up on their record. I've had instances of people legitimately thought that something was not on their record any longer, and it still was on their record, and they got disqualified because they didn't reveal it early in the process. You know, it seems incredible if you're not familiar with the justice system, how can this happen? But it's really easy. Legal gobbledygook to an 18-year-old that may or may not have been told right to them or explained right to them. When someone's 30 years old, what do you really retain? Out of that. So it's a terrible minefield for people with records.
Look, I know as an executive in my former life, just the HR, don't even put that subset in the world. It's complicated enough. And then you start adding that and you're like, oh my gosh, I just, you know, keep me away from it because I'm going to say something wrong or do something I shouldn't.
Right. You know, I take a different tack than some people who are in the justice reform movement. I don't get hung up on language. You know, there's this whole thing, what's the language you're supposed to use?
Yep.
And my experience is that if you start off by scolding people about what language they're starting to use, their response is not, oh, okay, I'll be sure and I'll be just as engaged using the right language. Their response is, I don't even want to be involved with this because I don't know if I'm going to say something wrong. And most people with records, they just want a job and to be treated with dignity as human beings. And they know well-meaning people will figure out the language sooner or later.
Yeah, it's I've had multiple conversations with men and women who've come out of the prison system. And is it ex-con? Is it a returning citizen? Is it formerly incarcerated? Most of them that I talk to, they don't care. It's like, look, we were in prison, so call us whatever you want. And we're moving on, you know, and yet we all dance around it. So anyways, I don't know how we got down that path. But,
you know, look, it is tragic that someone for a mistake 30 years ago who's paid his dues might still be considered a felon. We all get that.
Totally.
But it shouldn't be the starting point of a conversation. I've been scolded by people because I say returning citizens, oh, they never stop being citizens. I talk second chances. They never had a first chance. So give me a break. Let's just get people, give them this opportunity and let's focus on that.
I appreciate your comments on that. So how would you say you're trying to change the world?
You know, I do have a day job where I'm trying to change our clients and customers' lives every day by giving them greater insight into the economy and the markets. But with regard to my work with Second Chances, I want everyone who is willing and able to work and get the benefits of work, pay, dignity, a place in society, I want them to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
And this is a group that is all too often denied that, or they may be able to land a low-level job, but have no economic mobility. So it's on that kind of individual basis, but it's also on the basis of, I love business owners, small business owners. That's one of the reasons I work where I work. I love people who've taken risk with their lives and created something new in the economy. I want them to be able to succeed, and labor is a key to that. And then finally, I think we are not living up to our aspiration to be the land of opportunity for all until we fix this. Mm. And so it's on a national level, it's on an employer level, and it's on an employee level. So it's immensely gratifying when it works, right? Because I'm hitting on three different layers.
Well, it reminds me, and I'm sure we've all heard some version of this, but when I play basketball, the coach would say, you know, you're only as good as your weakest player. And I think there's a lot of truth to that in life. So at one level, we kind of constrain, which is horrible. It's still a huge amount, 2 million people incarcerated, whatever, 6 million that are, you know, under supervision or whatever. And you go, that's kind of the world. And you go, no. It trickles down to families and communities. Yeah. And so it is something that we need to address as a country.
Yeah. If you're giving someone an opportunity, you're not just giving one person an opportunity. You're fixing a family. You're fixing communities. And
generationally.
And generally, yeah. There's so much at stake here.
Yep.
But we have to keep this discussion grounded. It's got to make sense from the standpoint of the employer. right? Companies might write a check to charity if they like the story, but they're only going to employ someone who can add value directly to their enterprise. And so it's got to work on that level.
Yeah, it's not simple. I have a good friend of mine here in the Orlando area who he hires formerly incarcerated, I think mainly men just based on the job, but it's whatever. And he has a deep, deep passion. I mean, I talked to him 6 months ago and there was some issue that happened. I don't even know what it was. And it was just that one issue made him go, oh, I got to rethink this whole thing. And that's one of the things we have to be careful of is, yeah, there's always going to be some bad apples in life in general.
Right.
And we can't let that be the deterrent on.
But it is important that you have the guardrails around the process so that if something goes wrong, you can say, well, this is the kind of thing that goes wrong with any large number of employees, right? Just stuff can happen. And that's frankly what all the data suggests. If you look at the real life studies, some of the places that have hired hundreds of people with criminal records, not all of them work out. But what's critical is there are no terminations that are related to the criminal record, that there are no, what the Johns Hopkins Hospital system in their experience called, and they had no problematic terminations.
Right.
And 500 people they had hired with records. That's important. And it is possible. Things can go wrong with any large number of employees, but you want to make sure that there's not a systemic problem in hiring from this population.
Yep. So one of the things that you and I briefly talked about just is how poverty plays a significant role in this. So along those lines, when did you realize the power of capital and what does that mean to you?
You know, I go back to George Gilder's book, Wealth and Poverty, which maybe a few of your listeners are old enough like me to remember. And this had a lot to do with capitalism being ultimately an altruistic system. I mean, that's the position in the book. I tend to think of it as more neutral, but the idea is you can only succeed as a capitalist and a true capitalist if you are offering something that others value.
Mm-hmm.
That's fundamental to free markets now. You can have crony capitalism where you use regulations to shut out competitors and things like that. But in a truly free market system, you are offering something of value. So I go back to probably 1980 in George Gilder's book was when I started to recognize the ability of capitalism to provide social goods. I've defined capitalism as the system that, you know, when I'm talking to a bunch of people who are in the labor market, that allows you, me, and everyone else who's in the labor force to make the world better for ourselves and our family by offering a good or service of value to others, right? That's the essence of capitalism. And I've had audience members come up to me and say, no, that's socialism. I'm like, no, it's not. That's capitalism. But I realized that as I started to get involved in this, look at the criminal justice system, I backed in from the employment side. I saw the labor shortage coming. I met employers that had focused on this. As I started to look at this as a system issue, I came to realize that there was a voice missing at the table in terms of our legal system, in terms of reform, and that was the employers. And we know that to rehabilitate, so someone to not recidivate, not get rearrested, the key is employment. And yet, no one in this world of policymakers was going out to employers and saying, what do you need?
Yeah.
And I tell my friends in the reform community, we will have much easier path to smart justice reforms when the business community looks at people who are justice impacted, who are currently in the system, whether arrested and not yet had a case adjudicated or who are under supervision or incarcerated. When the business community says, that's my workforce, current workforce or future workforce, how do I want them treated? We'll have a better justice system.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, and we could go down a long path here so we can cut it off if need be. And I think COVID changed this a little bit. But historically, if I would have talked about impact investing and how one of the things in impact investing is creating jobs, when you would apply that outside the U.S., people would say, yeah, that's an impact investment. When you were to say, hey, an impact investment here in the U.S. is part of investing in, you know, businesses that probably do good, but then also hire a bunch of people and create careers, they'd be like, eh, not, I don't know if that's really impactful. And I think part of that is we have, I think we're a very wealthy country. But I think we also have lost a little bit of the dignity of work. And I'll give you an example. I was in a prison system helping a group of inmates write resumes and job interviews. And first of all, they were unbelievably creative because they had jobs, not all of them, because there wasn't enough jobs. But I was relaying this story to a mid to late 20-year-old group, and they were offended that you know, somebody was hiring these inmates. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. Because they just assumed it was punishment. You're like, no, they want jobs. There's dignity in it. And so long story short, when I left that session, one of the things I told one of the gentlemen who's going to get out in the next, you know, I think at the time is about a year, I said, when you go do a job interview, what you need to tell them is you understand the value of work better than anybody. And by the way, he's out today doing extremely well in a leadership role, making very nice income, because part of it is he has this desire to work and he wants to work and he's studying for new tests to be licensed in this and that. But we've lost some of that, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there is a big difference in how these issues are viewed by people who've been incarcerated and people in the reform community who have not been incarcerated. And it's, of course, a minefield to walk through.
Yes.
But it is true. The selling point is someone who is eager to show that they are a good citizen and someone who can contribute is going to be a great employee.
Oh, yeah.
I spoke to someone who had spent time in the federal prison system, and he's in Arizona now, and he's doing extremely well. But he said the coaching they got was at the job interview, stress the federal bonding program, which protects for, I think it's 6 months, the first $5,000 in losses. And, you know, he said, what do you think of that? I said, well, you know, business owners who happen to know about this all say, I'm not worried about the first $5,000 in losses, right? That's inconsequential. And we agree the story is, how do you explain it? How do you position yourself? It's not a $5,000 bonding program. It's think of the worst mistake you ever made in your life. And if you've paid some heavy dues for that, separated from family, and you want to prove yourself, that's the kind of employee you're going to be.
So it's interesting. We've started Redemption 360, which is we're going to be investing in businesses that are run by or that are hired formerly incarcerated. And I will tell you, in some early due diligence that I've done of individuals and companies, I'm not so sure this is across the board, but to talk to some of these people who have been released, have been absolutely humbled and have changed, their desire to succeed is for themselves, for their family, for the community is off the charts. And you go, my gosh, if you can just come alongside and harness that energy and bring resources, whether it be capital, whether it be relationships, these people will fly. And I truly believe we're going to see that.
Yeah. And I have to say, not all of them, right?
Yep.
There are people who, for whatever reason, seem to be on a path to be repeat offenders. So the key is having a process that can figure out who are the ones ready to turn their life around. The other thing I should have mentioned when you talked about, you know, people want jobs and all that, and the dignity of work. Steve Smith, who was a principal at Brandywine Investments, heard me speak, and he came up to me and said, I'd like to help. And Steve very, very generously donated money to a nonprofit called Books Inside, which is technically Utah-based, so the principal there lives in Colorado. You know how this world of trying to cobble things together. And we've sent 500 books to prison libraries.
Yeah.
And the reason is, it's ultimately a message of hope, because I want people who are currently incarcerated to know that not everyone sees them as a burden on society.
Yeah.
A lot and a growing number of people see them as a resource for our country and a resource for their communities and a resource for the companies. And that's an important message, because you spend your time differently if you think there's hope.
Yeah.
And much more constructively.
Yeah. At some point, have you ever heard of a guy by the name of Pete Oakes?
I don't think so.
So they have two businesses that they run that half, I don't know if exactly half, but let's just say, well, part of the employees are not incarcerated. The other part is incarcerated. And the stories coming out of that business and the lives of these individuals who have an employer who's actually there in the prison pouring into them, the generosity from those men who are incarcerated is way higher than the generosity of those who are not. This whole idea of, can people change? Absolutely. Can people grow? Absolutely. And for somehow people think that if you get behind the bars, you're in a different world than everybody else. It's like, no, we all can change. Now, doesn't mean everybody does.
That's correct. And I think one of the challenges that I see is too many employers have tried it, but tried it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And in my work, I've identified effectively three different models. And one is, you know, I think, I don't want to blame the industry, but a fast food restaurant franchise where they just want cheap employees. It's low skill, high turnover work. So they'll collect the work opportunity tax credit. And if someone only stays 6 months, so be it. And they're on to the next. It's better than nothing. I certainly don't condemn them, right? Because that's better than saying no. And some people are able to use that. But if you're not looking for talent, you won't find it. So you'll have high turnover, lower quality. And, you know, this is aided and abetted by the fact that a lot of businesses say, just give me a nonviolent drug offender. Well, maybe that's a person who's still struggling with substance mm-hmm. abuse and is not destined to be a good employee. And then there's this other model of, which I call the undifferentiated model, where you try to be selective, your heart's in the right place, but you have no idea of how people from this background struggle with transportation, housing, community supervision restrictions. And you find those who have stable housing, maybe higher levels of sophistication, resources, do turn into that exemplary employee, but half just don't show up one day because mm-hmm. no one ever told them, you know, your car breaks down, you're supposed to call in. Or, you know, if your car breaks down, you might need $300 for a repair, or you might need a credit card to call an Uber to get into work, or, you know, all of these things that a lot of people coming out of the system don't have.
Well, and then even just in the system, especially if you're in there for a long time, people forget that, you become a product of that. And so for them, they're told when to do everything.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I actually had a guy that I know, not in a different context, when he used to work out in prison, it was survival. And now one of the things that he's out, he's having to train himself to go, when I work out, it's for just my health. It's not because I'm trying to protect myself. So, I mean, it's stuff that we take for granted. It's like, oh, geez, I've never worked out at thinking that.
Prisons are not a healthy place for rehabilitation because they don't foster on their own, tend not to foster sort of healthy interactions a lot of the time. And people can be taught, right? Because they may never have been taught ground rules for life the way you and I take for granted. There's a wonderful program out of Minnesota, the Redemption Project, which has, they get employers in coaching, mentoring, and also effectively interviewing. But before that, there's a virtue-based program. How do you make life decisions? Mm-hmm. How do you decide who you are as a human being? And those are things that we've probably had seep into us in our upbringing, but not everyone has.
Yeah. And I mean, those are some of the things you go, why aren't we talking about that in school a little bit more?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, now you hope it would be done in the family, but still those are important things. Well, the next question I have is around stewardship, and I'm going to be specific to you. Why do you spend time and energy on this?
It's my way of contributing. I think I'm in a unique position. Working for a bank that has a lot of access to middle market employers. I happen to stumble across these employers. I have access, until recently, no academic ever talked to any of them. And it's hard work, right? You got to collect these employers with lots of travel. It so happened that I travel a lot for work. So I can find employers and gather the lessons in ways that it would be very hard for, you know, someone in the academic world to do. You know, I want a grant because I want to travel to 50 different cities and try and dig up employers with 150 employees who have below the radar been hiring people with criminal records and find them and get them to open up to me. Well, I was actually able to do that over 10 years. So part of it, I'm doing it because I'm the one who can. Mm-hmm. And then you just see the opportunities and you see that it can make a difference in lives. I feel like I have been repaid many times over from the effort and the stress of doing this. And I'll tell you where I'm repaid. I'm thrilled when people get jobs and all that. But I went from zero friends who've been incarcerated to a whole bunch of them. Mm. And I got to say, they are some of the most stand-up people in my life because they've been tested by fire. Mm-hmm. And I'm really blessed to have these friends. I love diversity. I love people who've had different life experiences. And oh my, have they had different life experiences. And they add richness to my life and some really good friendships. So I'm grateful to them for being in my life. And that's how I'm paid.
Yeah, I would just echo that that comment. And I think the common denominator there is, and take out any walls or any prison walls in any of this, it's men and women who've been broken and who surrender and live more than just for themselves. Those are inspiring people to be around. All right, so if you could have one dream come true in your life, what would that be?
Wow.
And if it's helpful to you, I can leave your family out of it. That way it...
Well, let's say related to this.
Okay.
I think I have something of value to offer. I would love it. Some celebrity to embrace it, or someone to kind of cut through the fog. I'm a slogger. The only way I know how to do something is just like brute force and hours of work and giving up weekends and evenings. And that's okay, because I find it worthwhile, but I want a shortcut. I want someone in the high levels of government to highlight it, or a business celebrity or a Hollywood celebrity or something like that, the way, some of them have been out there. That'd be my dream. And it's not about the money, obviously.
Right. So let's just go down that path. What would success look like to you if something like that you just described could happen?
My ability to contribute here is for people to know about my work, to know that this is a viable labor pool and that there's a right way to do it.
Okay.
So it is that recognition. It doesn't mean people don't have to do a hard level of work, but I think it could shortcut this national dialogue. If people were to have greater awareness, there's a book out there that is reasonably easy to read and as a guide to doing it right.
Have you had any, and you can leave names out, have you had any major corporations, companies talk to you about this to try to figure it out?
Yes. And there are.
Will somebody figure it out in a meaningful way?
Yes. And you have organizations like the Second Chance Business Coalition, which are trying to drive this and drive best practices. And, they've cited my work, and I've worked with the National Association of Manufacturers through their Manufacturing Institute, which is their education arm. So we're getting there. But to me, this is a law of numbers game. If you're able to reach only a few thousand people who look at this, you'll get maybe 100 who really give it a good look, and maybe a dozen who try to implement something. So you really need to get out there and reach a million businesses. And I'm not saying that figuratively. I'm saying, literally. I don't know how many businesses there are in the U.S., but it's probably something in that, in that number. That's what you want. And there's some things that are cooking. I'm hoping that the CARES Act relief that's given to states, maybe some of them will use this to do something. I've been involved in some convenings where we try to get business leaders under one roof and listen to this, and there's a good response. So that's still kind of a slog, that wish you asked for. I'd like to shortcut it. Who doesn't want to make their life easier in achieving a mission?
Well, look, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. I love the kind of the two paths you're on, and I hope people will come go check out your book, Untapped Talent. I have not read it, but I will go order it as soon as I get done here. I look forward to reading it. It's obviously right up the alley of what I'm looking for.
So just to be explicit, it can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, wherever fine books are sold. If people want some links, go to jeffkorzenek.com. I'm the only Jeff Korzenek on the planet or in the known universe. And if you can get close to spelling my name, you can find that. And there's a section that gives you links to buying it.
Wow, that's awesome. So anyways, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.